that's smart use of competition. And this one here with KFC, oh, I don't get anything out of it.
Let me start with posing this question for you.
Okay.
Why is math necessary in marketing?
I'm going to answer it with a little bit of metaphorical talk here.
To get better at math, you need to be strong in the prerequisite to whatever it is that you're learning.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Marketing Podcast here again, episode number 42. This is Shaheen Khan with Doug Garnett, as usual. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing well, Shaheen.
Excellent. You're up in the Pacific Northwest.
I am. I was down in the central Oregon this last week, but I'm back home now. We're going back again this week.
How close did you get to the eclipse?
Not close enough, I'll tell you. We didn't see much eclipsing up here, but you know, when was it? 4 or 5 years ago, it came through Oregon, and we got very close.
That was a big one. You got like the full totality back then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We didn't decide to drive into the traffic to get to the full totality that year, but we got close, so yeah, it was significant. Yeah.
Well, we have some mutual total photography buff friends who have done that. And of course, they come back with these fabulous photos. So but I'd rather sit home and just look at their photos. And by the way, every time I see eclipse, I read eclipse, as in like this electronic version of clips.
It's like the something on your computer that clips things to your desktop, I'm sure.
There's
got to
right.
be something in here that we can...
Goes with e-commerce.
Yeah, e-commerce. Mm-hmm. When Apple does it, they're going to be iClips.
So. That's right. So it's a good segue to the cartoon of the week, and we have something in the cart.
We do, and once again features Amazon. And here we have a father who has lovingly taken his son out to see the eclipse, and the son is holding his eclipse glasses. And the father says, "Son, we won't see this many eclipse glasses returned to Amazon for another 20 years. I don't know what to make of it. I just thought it was quirky and weird, and I liked it.
Well, it's good and topical, too.
Yeah.
But I thought those glasses are like not returnable, or are they actually returnable?
That's a good question. I wonder if there are going to be a lot of people that it's like people who buy the dress to wear it to a prom and then return it afterwards. I suppose it could be that type of eclipse glasses. So
I see. But, you know, you could say, like, if you're selling umbrellas during rain, maybe you should rent them.
Maybe so. Maybe that's it. There's a big market for rentable eclipse glasses, I suppose. That might be the thing.
Let's get back to the first topic of the session.
Well, I think we're going to start by busting a myth. And the myth goes deep back in time. I mean, just Shaheen and I were you and I were talking during the warm-up. We both remember this from the 80s. So what can you say? But soaps.
In elementary school.
That's right. Snopes. And in fact, they wrote this quite a while back, but it appeared on our radar this week that Snopes has an article about the Chevy Nova. And if you've been around marketing, you've probably heard the Chevy Nova myth. And the idea is that the Nova car didn't sell well in Spanish-speaking markets. And that the reason was that Nova means won't go in Spanish, and therefore, look what bumbling idiots they were at Chevrolet. They should have known that, and they should have changed the name. And it's the ultimate morality story for localizing things when you go into foreign language markets. Snopes suggests we ought to take some caution, because it turns out to be false, that it looks like the Nova sold just fine in markets. They did a whole bunch of deep digging, and you can find it on Snopes.com, their fact check on the Chevrolet Nova. And turns out that it sold just fine. People weren't confused in it. And there are a whole bunch of things about why we should stop using that as our ultimate morality tale. And they make a few points, such as the phrase Nova and the word Nova are different words with different pronunciations in Spanish. And they suggest that it's like various things in English where, you know what, if we pronounced them different, we'd also think those were pretty weird too. So.
And they had some examples of it, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They had, let's see. Well, a few examples that are worth. The myth apparently fully says that they had to change the word Nova to Caribe, and then it sold well. But there's a problem that actually the Caribe was made by Volkswagen, not by Chevrolet. So that turns out not to be exactly true. and that it didn't affect sales. Oh, and they actually point out that the Mexican government oil monopoly sold gasoline in Mexico under the brand name Nova. So, I don't think I'd buy gasoline that meant won't go if that really was it. So, anyway.
Yeah. Now, I have a very positive impression of that car.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's had several incarnations within the General Motors portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
But the original Nova was, at least in my recollection, a fabulous car. And many people were sad to see it go.
And I think there's a pretty hot collector market in these days. So if you have one in mint condition sitting in your garage, you ought to look at the auction market. You might do well with it then, you know?
Yeah. But the brand finally did go, even though it was supposed to not go.
That's right. Oh, my.
All right. So that's not a bad segue into like how you advertise things. And there was a big thread about what not to do in advertising. Let's talk about that.
All right. So this one comes out of the advertiser in question is Kentucky Fried Chicken, who is affectionately known as KFC. And they came out with a series of ads, it appears, that, well, some people raised questions about. And because we always have this challenge of, do you include your competition in your advertising or not? And is it a good thing or a bad thing? And I think we're all searching for universal rules and they don't exist. But on the other hand, here's what KFC did, is they have a series of ads with people who are eating not KFC stuff. So one has a woman eating a burger, another one has a guy eating a hot dog, another one has a guy eating some nondescript mush. I'm not sure what it is. And it all says, the tagline is, everything reminds you of KFC. The theory that they're all licking their fingers, therefore we're smart enough, we're going to make that connection. And I don't know. All I walk away from is I think, boy, that's a good looking burger. And that hot dog looks really nice. I don't know about the mush.
Well, in fact, it looks like the burger is so good that they're licking their fingers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, over at the top of the ad, it has KFC right there. And it says it's like, we can't forget about it. And over up there, they say finger licking good, which was a good tagline that they had many years ago that they brought back.
Yep.
But I agree that it doesn't quite deliver the message the way I think it is intended.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. The other thing we should mention is like KFC changed their name from Kentucky Fried Chicken to KFC. And I think they did that because fried was like not a good thing.
Well, I think that's what they were afraid of, is that it was working against them. And I think this kind of stuff I think is really tough, that companies get a little too sensitive to themes about certain kinds of words. And the question to me is, fried food seems bad. Not fried food seems good. But I'm not sure that really is affecting consumers nearly as much. And they could have had down sales and thought that would do it. And in fact, be just fine leaving the word fried there if they advertised in different ways. So they became very sensitive to that.
Yeah, it was a tough branding decision. Clearly having three letters is better than Kentucky Fried Chicken. But then when you make it KFC, you do lose fried, but you also lose Kentucky and chicken.
Right. And in this ad, they've lost the colonel. So,
and they've lost the colonel. That's right.
Yeah. And I think all that stuff concerns me because KFC doesn't look quite, I mean, and we all still call it Kentucky Fried Chicken. One of the things that people who do brand name changes forget, I mean, 30 years from now, we'll still be calling X Twitter. And because right now I still call FedEx office Kinko's, even though that name change has been there for 20 years.
That's right.
It's hard to get people to replace what they already know in their minds. So I think that brand name is tough. I was going to say on these, I think the problem I do have with these ads, wherever they came from and however they came about, is they don't make the point well, you know? And if the point is that, oh God, I wish I had something, what are they trying to say? That just because I licked my fingers, I think of KFC? I don't think that's viable. So I'm really confused by what they think they're doing.
At a minimum, it's a stretch. But as it relates to featuring your competition in your ad, which is what the main advice was, which right on, when you look at this particular example with KFC, that makes perfect sense to me.
Yep.
Why do you want to show a burger when you're selling chicken? And by the way, the consumer seems quite pleased with it. But if you generalize it to, should I ever feature my competition in my, I'm not advertising my competition, I'm just featuring them. I think there are occasions where that's valid. And those occasions is where you're trying to position a product in a category that your audience may not see it as. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you have a car that is just a family sedan, normal car, and you feature a Rolls Royce in it, mm-hmm. nobody's confused that you're competing with Rolls Royce, but you're associating yourself with some of the qualities of Rolls Royce. And that may be valid. I mean, depending on how it gets implemented. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a general rule, which is you can always associate yourself up. If you compare up, you're okay. If you're at the top, you never compare down because that just takes away from your brand. But I was remembering, I used to show my class ads from Hyundai back in the 1980s when they were the Yugo of the 1980s. If you remember the Yugo, which was not a very well-made car out of Yugoslavia, just saying. But yeah, it was cheap. And the Hyundai, and these ads were brilliant ads because they embraced what Hyundai was. And so what the ads, all the sequence of ads were about how it's a practical, cost-effective choice. And I loved that they embraced the reality of the Hyundai in the ads. So I would show them to my class for that reason. One of them has a guy pulled, the guy in the Hyundai sitting in a stoplight, and somebody pulls up next to him in a Maserati. And he's looking full Chevy Chase, sunglasses, the asshole you hate, all this kind of stuff. And the light turns green, and the Maserati just rips out of there, and the guy in the Hyundai kind of takes on. And underneath it, the voice is talking about all the good things the Hyundai has that are similar to what are on the Maserati. And then eventually, it ends with the Hyundai passing the Maserati, which has been stopped by the police. And it talks about how much money you'll save by buying a Hyundai. And that one really worked because it's humorous. I'm not confused. I'm not going to go, I'm going to buy a Maserati because I saw that ad. And it all reflects well on the Hyundai. That's smart use of competition in the ad. This one here with KFC, I don't get anything out of it.
Yeah.
This doesn't do
anything. That's right.
But I think also, I was saying Pepsi, I have difficulties with because Pepsi does a lot where they'll feature a Coke in their commercial. And there's a thing that I teach about, which is the residual, which is once the ad disappears, what remains in your mind? Because what remains in your mind is what's going to influence you. So the ad disappears, what's left behind is the residual. And unfortunately for Pepsi, the residuals from all of those ads for me is always Coca-Cola. And that's a problem, is if you feature your competition in a way that you remember Coca-Cola, even though you're Pepsi, that's wrong. And you got to be really careful about that kind of stuff.
I agree. But just to sort of the devil's advocate here, what do you think about if your situation is that you have such a dominant competition that featuring them in your ad isn't going to really change anything for them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if it moves the needle for you just a little bit, that's still a win. I mean, I would hasten to like answer myself by saying that maybe there are better ads you could run. But, you know, is there a thought process that says, yeah, maybe I should do a taste test then?
Well, I think there can be. I think because you're looking at, let's call it borrowed glory, right? So if they're much bigger than your brand, you're trying to borrow glory from them. So in a taste test, you might be able to borrow glory. I think the trick is, like I said, with those Coke Pepsi, the Pepsi made ads that have a Coke in them, the residual is Coca-Cola, not Pepsi. And that's where there's a problem. So if you do that, where you put yourself in with a major product that you're far behind, you don't want the only thing people remember to be that major product. You somehow may have to make the ad work so that you're what people remember from. And if you can do that, then absolutely it's brilliant. I don't have any problem.
Right.
But it's at this level of residual. And I think we don't hear enough discussion about that residual, the what's left when things disappear. Companies get very focused on, well, we said this in the ad. Well, you got to figure out what people are remembering. Because you said, they're not necessarily going to remember what you said. They're going to remember what they take away.
We do hear like about unaided recall, but that's not what residual is. It's the sum total of the impression that you recall, not just recalling the brand.
Yeah, it's not just recalling the brand. It's usually the brand with, you want to have something with it. For example, we did an ad for Teflon, for some Teflon-coated cookware. And it was a coating that would, a special Teflon that would heat up faster and more evenly. And so within the ad, we had an animation of a pan warming up, showing bad and good. Right? Traditional Teflon and this new Teflon. And I was very pleased when we did research after the fact, because we talked about what images people remembered. That image of the side-by-side, which was the proof of the Teflon doing this thing, was what people remembered. And you think, okay, that's good. They remembered what I wanted them to remember, not the host or not the
right.
These other things, which are tangential to selling the product. So they remembered what the product did. And so I walked away saying, okay, that's good. That's
yeah, what I need. Yeah. I know that's a problem with a lot of Super Bowl ads. You remember the ad, but not the product, nor what to do about it.
Yeah, I remember that ad with, let's see, Jean-Luc Picard was in it with a bunch of other people, but what was it for?
And it was really funny.
It was really funny, but I can't remember what the hell it was for. I think in retrospect now, I'm like, I think it was for Paramount because he's a Star Trek actor. But.
Right. So last time we had the pleasure of having J.P. Caslin as a guest.
That was really fun.
It was, and definitely go listen to it if you haven't. But one thing he said, he was talking about the history of strategy, and he used the names Laplace and just some mathematical complexity. And I know in the book that you've written on strategy and complexity, math shows up in non-trivial ways, because in many ways, that's what you have to do to model some of these more complex things. So that led to the idea of math in marketing. And I remember saying that, don't be afraid of math. If you're a marketing professional, let's go. So I think this whole area deserves to be something that we put in the spotlight.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, I think we should probably cover it over a number of weeks, because there's a number of different angles on it. And I was thinking that today we should start by helping all of our listeners understand what we really mean by that. Because I think one of the dangers with the mere word math is it could be anywhere from times tables to manifolds in seven-dimensional space and all this kind of weird math. That I had a teacher, a prof in college, who was a number theorist, and she eventually got out of teaching and went to work for Bell Labs because she thought that her work actually mattered over there. And she said that, in fact, she would write papers, and it was such an arcane section of number theory that there were only two people in the world who could understand the math other than her. Yeah. And you're like, yeah, that's really off in there. So we're not talking about number theory here.
And for the record, number theory is highly relevant to cybersecurity and cryptography.
Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So like, lest you might think it's not relevant, it's highly relevant. And it's not just looking at digits. But let me start with posing this question for you.
Okay.
Why is math necessary in marketing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess I'm gonna answer it with a little bit of metaphorical talk here, right? Which is, numbers have always been in business from the beginning, right? In fact, there's 35,000-year-old cuneiform tablets from the Middle East, clay tablets with markings in them. They're some of the earliest known writing. And you think, oh, they found these tablets. They've got epic poetry on them, or they've got love songs, or they've got decrees from the kings. No, actually, they're accountant records. These cuneiform tablets are counting the sheep and how much is in the warehouse and transactions. So the reality is, business is and always has been done in a forest of numbers. So I'm using the idea of this forest of numbers. It's just reality. When we do business, we're in numbers. We have to be in numbers. It's just part of where we are in the world. The trick is, how do we respond to them? And so, as a way to start into this, I think there are people who obsess over the trees in the forests. And so they know how to analyze a tree really well. Yeah, that's not going to help us so much. There are people who want to find a hole in the ground and hope that by ignoring the math that they'll do just fine. And that's not very successful either. The success comes from two archetypes I see. One is, there's people who thrive in the forest, like the fox and the bear. They know how to navigate the forest to achieve what they want. And they tend to be pretty mathematically literate, and they tend to have just a good sense of all that, and they can do all the math themselves as well as understand it. And they do well. There's also another group who can't do the math themselves, but they're literate in why do they care. And they have a good judgment for the decisions that have to be made off the math. And I think that's one of the critical points here, is that math is only important in marketing in that we have to make decisions. And it's in informing those decisions. And so people who maybe don't know math as well can still have the instincts to say, wait a minute, that doesn't feel right. Are we really sure that the math says that? And challenge it. And we talked earlier, I mentioned my wife and I, we manage some commercial property business together. And I happen to be the first type, thriving in the forest. And she's of the second type. And I rely on her instincts to say, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. Then I'll go off and look at it and pursue it. So that's my sense of, like, why do we have to talk about this? But I think it's also to, maybe for listeners, say, you don't have to be a PhD mathematician here. And you have to be aware that the math in marketing is often relatively straightforward. One of the problems we have is a lot of people like to dress it up in language that's intimidating if you're not a mathematician.
I'm going to ask you another question, but then I'm going to come back and make some comments on this. It's also been criticized as the precondition for certain degrees or credentials, where in practice, it's not used as visibly as one might think. And there was a whole thread that you pointed me to about going beyond algebra and talking about, do I really need to pass an algebra course to get an art degree? Why is that a prerequisite? And then why am I not sort of focused on just simple numeracy instead of something a little bit higher up that is not going to be used at all? What is your perspective on that?
Yeah, if anybody wants to read up on this on the web, you can just do a search for Andrew Hacker, H-A-C-K-E-R, math. And he wrote a New York Times editorial that set ablaze the world of mathematics, because what he suggested was at the point where we move into algebra and beyond, so it's algebra, trig, calculus, geometry, we've moved into a different kind of math. And I think it's conceptually a different kind of math. And a lot of people don't thrive from that point forward. I loved algebra. I loved calculus. I hated geometry in high school. I liked geometry later when it made sense to me, but it took a while to get through that, but I thrived in it and liked it. His observation is that those have become seen as the foundation of education, and he suggests that they're not. And instead, he suggests that what we need to do is, for a lot of students, what we need is simply advanced numeracy. How do you deal with percentages, proportions, with ratios, with statistics, and a lot of the very practical stuff that we run into in marketing? And I think it's a useful thing to put on the table. He's been very controversial for having said this so loudly. And I think actually that he's right on. I've watched in my own kids, one who thrived with algebra and one who there's just no hope because his mind doesn't work in an algebraic way. And he really struggled. I think when you step to algebra, you start into abstraction. You're manipulating abstracts, and some people's minds don't do so well with that. The good news for marketers is I've got a master's in applied math, and I'm a really good Excel guy, and I sometimes even run correlations, but not often, because primarily what I've found is a need for how do I project what might happen for a campaign? What's the profit and loss going to look like? How do these costs pass forward? Not easy stuff, but not advanced mathematics in the sense of calculus and trigonometry.
So I want to add to this discussion by saying, if you're a marketing professional and if you feel the need to have strength in math, then right there, that's your justification. There's something that's causing you to think that you want to be stronger at it. And therefore, you should take steps to be stronger at it. What I also want to add is my observation and some of the reading that I've done lead me to believe that to get better at math, you need to be strong in the prerequisite to whatever it is that you're learning. And it goes all the way back down to simple arithmetic. So if additions and subtractions are hard for you, and they are for many people, well, then let's practice those. If your multiplication table is weak, then let's practice those. And this is really where the old style of teaching by repetition can really work, because a lot of those things can be memorized and you can just look them up rather than derive them in your brain again. What is 8 times 9? Boom, you can just get the answer immediately without even thinking about it. But that's a good prerequisite before you can do algebra. Your multiplication table is the prerequisite for multiplication table is just arithmetic, addition, subtraction. If you want to do ratios and fractions, and that's like division, so you need to go practice those. And the stronger you are in that, the easier everything else is going to be as you go up. And I think what happens in math is that as you go up, it becomes more and more difficult to maintain that strength, because the concepts become harder. And as you have mentioned, you may not even really need it. So then it's just fine. But for most of what we need to do, even in arts, you need to understand proportions. You need to be able to do measurements. You need to like think in 3D sometimes and how things come in, the topology of things. So geometry becomes relevant. So to me, it's just another tool, another language, really. I mean, we all learned English and it's immediately useful, as you mentioned. Some of the basic math is immediately useful as well. And just like you don't need to excel in Shakespeare, You also don't need to excel in partial differential equations until you get there for whatever reason.
Absolutely. And I think that's why I raised Hacker's thought, which is I think math is important in marketing, but not calculus. Sure, economists love to use calculus, but someday we'll go critique them and they're silly about it, in fact. But in marketing, we don't need that. We need fundamental strength in working with and manipulating numbers. And we need also to think of it more as a management skill. So as we manage what happens in marketing, if you think about my analogy in the forest, and there's the fox that knows how to weave their way through the forest, and then there's the person who knows how to hear what the report back from the fox and say, yeah, but what about this, right? That we need at minimum to become that person that's able to look at the numbers and ask questions. Some of that takes the confidence to push back at arbitrary uses of jargon, because I think there's a lot of times that jargon is used to impede questions rather than help them along. But also just to have an instinct. When you talk about the math tables, one of the things I've found myself to be good at is I can look at a set of numbers and say, something's wrong. And to use a term, like the term I just picked up out of history, is to cross-examine the numbers. Managers need to be able to cross-examine numbers. Doesn't mean you need to know the answer. But when you see something that seems wrong, you need a way to question it and investigate it, or have your people investigate it. And I very often in my management would have somebody bring me a set of numbers and I'd look them through and I'd go, yeah, but this one looks out. And they would go back and look and come back and say, oh yeah, we had a spreadsheet problem there. Because these days numbers go through all these calculations and manipulations and things. The potential for error is tremendous. Now, it's hard not to have that. I mean, it's probably harder to get that confidence when you don't have a master's in applied math, but it can be done because it's really about practical decision making. You've got to make decisions about marketing and they need to be based on an understanding of what numbers can inform you about. And therefore, in marketing, that's probably our key primary number skill, is just to be able to read, look, and understand what they imply for what you're doing.
I do want to add, though, that while few marketing organizations have a view of what their demand and supply curve looks like, but if you remember from microeconomics, marginal cost, marginal utility, every time you say marginal, that's a derivative. So you're starting to get into calculus, and then knowing that is actually immensely useful, because there are people who totally get that and say, oh, it's just a derivative. Why didn't you tell me? And I'm trying to understand the propensity to consume and say, oh, well, if you just told me the math version of it, I could not only immediately understand it, I would also figure out how they're impactful and what I need to accomplish, all of that.
So in that way, is part of the challenge that math is a language. And if people are not comfortable in that language, then you're trying to communicate across a boundary that's difficult.
So you can get better at it by practicing it, by using it, by learning it, but then if you don't know the alphabet, it's going to be hard to write it. So that's the foundation part. Now, the other thing that came out of this discussion was the idea of math being about something or being immediately useful. Those were the two dimensions. Comment on that, if you would.
Well, one of the challenges I think we do have in math education is we present a lot of things before they make any sense. And Andrew Hacker has a comment that he says every other subject's about something. Poetry is about something. Even most modern art is about something, although he's being generous to modern art. No, I like that. Just kidding. But he says math is about nothing. And it's not that math is about nothing. But I remember when I was taking geometry in high school, and I did well in the class, but we'd get into the sine and the cosine and tangents. And we'd have these tables, and you'd go, here's how you look up the answer. But I never understood why I needed the answer. Well, I needed the answer to answer that test question. Yeah, but that's not enough. I need to know why I should care. Eventually, when I got into calculus, we looked at transferring into an R theta approach to three-dimensional space. It all makes sense. But it's one of the problems we have in math is it needs to be about something. And I think a lot of people fight that. And so those marketers, I think, who feel frustrated, I think part of it is focus on what this stuff really means. What is this stuff connected with? It's not the ability to manipulate numbers arbitrarily, although that's what gets you to a master's degree. But anyway, it's not about that. It's more, why do I care? what is this stuff doing for me? And I think that's actually a split in math. Hackers suggest that most other fields aren't like that. And even at least English, you learn a new word. We've all had kids who found some new word, even if it's a four-letter word, and want to practice it on their parents. And that happens all the time. But an immediate joy that can come out of English, that's not there with math.
I liked your rendition better when you talked about being useful.
Yeah.
And when you talk about all these other subjects, you have an immediate understanding of where they're useful, what they're good for, why you would want to do it. Whereas, as you mentioned, you may study partial differential equations and you don't know why you're doing it.
Yeah.
And that is a problem. So I like that one better than whether it's about something. But of course, part of what he said was that it's about nothing. And then he said almost like Seinfeld.
Right.
And for those of you who remember the comedy series Seinfeld, a big thread there was that it was a show about nothing. And there was an article written way earlier about another comedy show called Three's Company in the old days, in which the author also said that it's about nothing. So, but it became popularized during Seinfeld. So that reminded me of a tweet I had some years ago. So I want to talk about it because I find it funny. Mm-hmm. So you have Jerry Seinfeld on one end. Here's a show about nothing. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have Ingmar Bergman, the Swedish director, whose movies are extraordinarily complicated for at least me. So I sort of came up with the Seinfeld-Bergman spectrum, and I'd applied it to the launch activities that we did in the old days. And I would say at one end of the spectrum, you've got a Seinfeld launch, which is about nothing. You just like gather the media and you said about stuff and it's like, what did you actually announce?
Right.
At the other end, you're announcing something so complicated that it's like watching an Ingmar Bergman movie. And the way I described it was, what's important, but you don't get it.
I think I've participated in releases of both ends of that.
That's right. And if you haven't watched an Ingmar Bergman movie, some of them really are not very accessible. But when you're sitting through them, you have a sense that they're very important.
Right, right.
And if you're watching it in a movie theater, then you don't want to like get up and leave halfway through because you just prove to everybody you're not getting it.
That's true. And hence, this is back to the politics of marketing. If you get up and walk out of the mathematics presentation in marketing,
be careful.
You don't want to know what you just implied to everybody. You just don't really want to go there. So,
all right. All right. So maybe we can conclude on that note.
I think so. I think for our listeners, what we've talked about is now with this little bit of stuff about math is maybe look at some of the specific areas like accountancy and strategy and projection. There are a few things, and from time to time, we'll scatter some in because I think it is a really important issue. And I haven't seen a thread of stuff out there that is really tremendously helpful for marketers to figure out how to dig into this.
Well, we're going to come back and double click on this in various parts of the spectrum. And I look forward to that.
That'll be great.
Good stuff. Thank you, Doug, as always.
Absolutely. Thank you, Shane.
All right. Thank you all. Take care. Until next time.
That's it for this episode of The Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.